Hello, and welcome to EDUCAUSE Now.
As we slide into the year-end holidays, we bring you some informative audio that we hope makes your campus a little brighter.
We'll check in with our new EDUCAUSE Vice President for Policy and Analysis, Greg Jackson, and ask him what policy issues and projects he's looking at for the new year.
And January 19th through the 21st brings the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting to Austin, Texas. You'll hear from ELI Associate Director Veronica Diaz about what to expect at that event.
And if you're interested in what you hear on EDUCAUSE Now, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE, or look at our show notes for links and descriptions related to the show at www.educause.edu/now.
First, we bring you a discussion about a turning point facing many campuses. For a good while, the coming e-textbook revolution has been anticipated by campuses to lower costs for students and add flexibility for instructors. As the technology promises more interactive, lower-cost content, and print textbook prices continue to soar, what's holding up the switch?
Well, I discussed the issue with three folks who presented on the topic at the EDUCAUSE 2009 annual conference. They include Darla Runyon, Assistant Director and Curriculum Design Specialist for SITE at Northwestern Missouri State University, Robin Schulze, English Department Head at the Pennsylvania State University, and Paul Musket, Associate Director for the University Bookstore at the University of Missouri. By the way, the conversation you're about to hear is an excerpt. Be sure to download the full 20-minute conversation beginning Friday, December 11th. One study I read suggests that a typical college student spends up to $1,000 a year on textbooks, and many students don't buy textbooks at all because they're too expensive. Could you talk specifically about how your campus is addressing this problem?
This is a continuing issue on the Penn State campus, and I should say that the cost is well over $1,000 a year. And trying to figure out how you manage that is a very difficult issue. I know that a lot of our students have actually taken things into their own hands, like many students do on campuses, and they've formed consortium groups in various classes where there will be, say, 20 kids who buy one textbook, and then they will make Xerox copies, they will make scans, they will find whatever way they can to disseminate all the information in those textbooks without buying more than one copy. But trying to figure out how we're going to manage this. I know that rental has been something that has been sort of posed on the horizon as perhaps a solution. We do have electronic reserves like everyone else, but then there are copyright issues all over the place with that in terms of what can you use and how much can you use and what happens there. So we're kind of up against it in a lot of ways.
But until the students grasp the digital book idea, it's kind of problematic. They come from K through 12, generally, where they don't have those.
That's right.
To this environment where it appears to be a good deal. The promise of 50% of the new price, that's not holding. We're seeing anything from 35 to 42% off is all you're getting.
Yeah, we've seen course content problems with it's only 20% off. And at that point, then there's not a whole lot of difference in getting an electronic book than there is in going to your best discount house and getting the hardcover.
Do you, any of you guys have insights onto the reasoning behind this kind of pricing?
They have to recoup their costs. I mean, you pitch yourself against the publisher immediately. You know, they want to sell new books every time. If a book costs $100 or a book costs $40 to a student, if someone's willing to pay that student $20 for it, well, that's $20 cash they need for something else. So they're trying to figure out how they can get their R&D covered, their intellectual property costs, pay their royalties, pay their fees. And an e-model is good, but they're seeing that their costs creep up also. So whatever the market will bear.
You know, when I think about the issues of R&D and book design and all these things, those of us who work at university campuses that have really great faculties, then it's always an interesting thing to think of the textbook producer in whatever form as being essentially the delivery middleman. And I think a lot of the publishers are getting a little bit worried about this in an electronic universe where it's becoming more and more possible to think about, well, gee, what would happen if Penn State just decided it was going to produce its own books?
Faculty have that content knowledge to develop the e-textbook, but they don't have the skills to develop the interactive pieces we're wanting to see in an electronic textbook. That publishers probably have those people, I'm pretty sure, on board doing that now. That whole curriculum that you would develop would take quite a bit of development, you know, time. And then And more staff.
But I really think that the universities that pursue this aggressively are going to come out really well in the end.
Mm-hmm. Do both of you have groups on campus, like educational technologies or instructional technology groups, that then assist faculty in grading course content?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If a department were to create educational materials for classes, there are people, time, and things to consider.
Right.
And how will those mm-hmm. people be compensated, or more so the department be compensated for employing those people to create the content?
With your experience with e-textbooks, do they engage the student better than paper textbooks?
We started out with a reader, and our students didn't like a reader at all. And so then we do give everybody a notebook computer on campus, and that seemed to go a little bit better. We, this fall, have been using a delivery system that is standard, and it does allow them then to highlight and search and share notes and those kinds of things. However, they may not have gotten more value out of it, but we're hoping that they did use those.
The human factor for value is not to be undersold. I mean, if the
right.
faculty member mm-hmm. is very, very interested in the electronic textbook
mm-hmm.
and really makes an effort,
exactly.
if the faculty member is already resistant to the process, there's just no way you're going to sell it to anybody, no matter
no.
what you do. It's interesting for me sitting here because, of course, I'm the head of a department of English. And when you're talking about textbooks, you're not really talking about the same thing that we use for humanistic content in an English department. So for me, what worries me a lot about the reader situation and the computer situation is you've got divergent desires. On the one hand, you want to create these incredibly lush, rich virtual environments in which students learn, which are all hyper-connected. In other words, your students get so engaged in where they can go and what they can do and how many things that they can do that the notion that they're actually paying attention to anything that's in the content-driven portion of your program is pretty much suspect. Will any of this allow for that kind of deeply immersive humanistic reading that English professors like me really, really like?
Get them to settle down and read.
Damn. I really think it's very important for academics all over the United States to start taking the hardware issues of reading and learning more seriously. We're ceding a lot of important developments to people who are really entertainment engineers. And if we want students to learn and to think in the ways that we as academics want them to learn and think, this is a hardware issue.
I was talking with a publisher and he was saying something and I'm standing there thinking to myself, wait a minute, you're not looking at it from our side here and you need to hear what we have to say. And they want to hear that and they want to try things and they want to do pilots and experiments to find out what is going to work.
Anything you'd like to add, Paul?
It's going to be an interesting ride.
Yeah. Darla Runyon, Robin Schulze, and Paul Musket. Be sure to download the full conversation beginning Friday, December 11th.
Each year in late January, the ELI community comes together to network and explore teaching, learning, and technology topics. This year, the conference takes place in Austin, Texas, January 19th through the 21st. EDUCAUSE Now spoke with Veronica Diaz, Associate Director of ELI, and Malcolm Brown, Director of ELI, about what attendees can expect at this year's gathering.
I'm Malcolm Brown. I'm the Director of the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. We've sort of put a more intense spotlight on the unveiling of the Horizon Report. The Horizon Report always gets unveiled at the annual meeting, and this year it's a featured session. In addition to that, we're going to follow that with 30 minutes of what we call lightning rounds. Those are mini reports from schools that are already actively working with the technologies identified in the Horizon Report. So that will help to contextualize the report and give folks a better idea as to actually how some of these technologies will play out on campuses across the country.
I'm Veronica Diaz, Associate Director for the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. Yeah, well, there are several items actually that are new that we've tried to bring in and have actually committed from folks. Some of those have to do, for instance, with Google Wave, where we will share Google Wave accounts with all of our ELI annual meeting member attendees. Also, we are going to be having what we call experiences sessions, where people will actually be able to come in and experiment with things like Google Wave or, for instance, with iPod touches.
The other thing that I'm very interested in is our Learning Circle lineup for this annual meeting. brainstorming sessions in which we bring in significant questions in the area of teaching and learning, one too big for any one person to handle. And we introduce the question at the Learning Circle and then brainstorm with the attendees as to what the best practices are to find solutions for that challenge.
When people think about EDUCAUSE, they often think about the annual meeting, which is really large. There's a lot of people there. But ELI is a very small, intimate setting where folks can really meet people and spend some time really interacting and understanding different things that are working and not working across the country as it relates to challenges in teaching and learning.
I think ELI aspires to be not just a place where people report on what they're doing, but an interactive session. That is where we're actively interacting and brainstorming on solutions. So the things that we talk about all have research components. They all have interactions built in with the audience so that we're constantly brainstorming and thinking about what's being presented, evaluating it, and looking at it and seeing if it makes sense for our particular context. In addition to the Twitter back channel, we're also going to be having waves going on, as Veronica mentioned, throughout the annual meeting so that we can offer the attendees yet another channel to confer, evaluate, and interact.
Malcolm Brown and Veronica Diaz. The ELI annual meeting will be held January 19th through the 21st.
EDUCAUSE recently added a new vice president for policy and analysis with Greg Jackson. He's the former vice president and CIO at the University of Chicago. I recently spoke to Greg by phone to ask what policy issues he's looking at for 2010.
Have you been settling in all right?
Well, settling in substantively, yeah. A lot of this is stuff that's familiar to me, which is why it was exciting to be able to do this. And then there's always new wiggles and wonders and, of course, adapting to a new organization, new locale and so on. But yeah, settling in well.
What are some of the issues and projects you're looking at for 2010?
Well, half of them will be things that we don't anticipate because that's the nature of policy work. But let me list several of the things that I know are on the agenda right now because I think most of these will continue. There's obviously all the peer-to-peer file sharing stuff. This came in the higher education reauthorization. But it keeps popping up in all kinds of sort of weird locales. So helping institutions to comply with regulations and helping agencies to figure out what the right way to think about this is something we'll be continuing. There's a lot of activity right now around network neutrality. This is something that higher education clearly favors, the idea that the internet should carry traffic on an equal basis regardless of substance and originator and so on. But once you really push on it, there's all kinds of very interesting complications behind there. And so we play the role both of an expert and of an advocate, which in itself is an interesting balance for us to strike. There's a lot of stuff about information security and privacy. That has been an issue. It'll continue to be an issue, partly just because it's an important issue and partly because we're seeing increasing amounts of regulation of different sorts. For example, things like new regulations about how institutions have to handle breaches and the like. And then, as I just said, that relates to privacy, but then there's a whole set of issues around privacy, which we think are going to grow in importance as institutions deal with difficult times. We start seeing a lot of layoffs, which are sad and difficult in their own right, but they also cause a lot of administrative problems in terms of access to email and employees who are no longer there but whose addresses are receiving organizational business and how you deal with the privacy issues. So a lot of things like that and many others which I'm sure I'm forgetting.
Is there anything happening on the federal level that's affecting higher ed in the coming year?
Oh, there certainly will be. As I say, a lot of the peer-to-peer stuff, that continues to be of great interest in the Congress, and so we need to keep a close eye on regulations that pop up here and there. So there was just a bill introduced either yesterday or the day before, for example, which requires anybody installing software that might be construed to be peer-to-peer to do certain kinds of notifications, and that becomes something that institutions might have to comply with. I actually don't think that bill will go anywhere, but you never know. And on the whole question of privacy and breaches of personal information and notifications and the like, I mean, it's quite clear that there's a great deal of interest in the federal arena, both to make sure that there are reasonable requirements there and to try to organize the current mess that results from 50 different state regulations. And so I think we're going to see things happening on that. And the network neutrality rules, which will emerge in some form from the Federal Communications Commission, will not affect most institutions except for the good, in the sense that network neutrality is a good thing. But there are some institutions that are, in effect, public network providers, and they may well have to change things that they do in order to comply.
Greg Jackson, Vice President of Policy and Analysis for EDUCAUSE.
Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find more EDUCAUSE podcasts, visit our iTunes channel by searching for EDUCAUSE, or find our podcasts on the web at www.educause.edu/podcasts. I'm Colleen Luckett.
And I'm Jerry Bain.
Happy New Year!